Aloha, mud babies, pod people, and inhabitants of the planet Earth. It is I, your tiki leader, Steve Mudflap McGrew. I know it has been much too long since the last podcast. The holiday season jacked with me, and I hope you had a good Christmas. I did. Got some great gifts. Got an 1860 Army cap and ball black powder pistol. Oh, one of the coolest things to shoot ever. Took it out this weekend. Had a great time. But now is the time for the podcast. Get back in the cycle of things. Got a great guest today, Ben Roy. Ben is a Denver comic that is blowing up on the scene and doing great everywhere. And I'm happy to have him back on the show today. Let's get this thing started. It's time to remasculate. Here's Ben Roy.
All right, I finally lured this guy back down into the basement with the hope of candy. I didn't have a van to use, but I said, hey, little boy, do you want to come down to the basement and for some candy and a podcast? And
sure, you got long hair. it's good to be back in the basement.
Good to be back. It's Ben Roy, ladies and gentlemen. It's been months. I've been after you to come back, and you got busy. You got really busy with all of your busy stuff.
Yeah. But a lot of it, too, is just the family. You know what I mean? Like trying to balance that.
So. Work and family?
Work and family.
That is it is almost impossible in this day and age.
It's not. It's not fun. It's definitely laborious because it's. I think I said that before. Or maybe we talked about that. But I think that that comedy, entertainment, will kill my relationship.
Oh.
It survived me drinking.
Right. Well, if it made it that far, it may still continue through the whole thing.
Oh, yeah.
If you make it through a drinking period and the period of sobering up, which is the hardest part.
Yeah.
It's not even the drinking. They kind of know you're an idiot and you drink and they forgive you. But that sober up part where you start trying to figure out and forgive and do they really like the honest you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's the tough part.
And Toby Keith actually had a song called You Ain't That Much Fun Since I Quit Drinking.
Yeah.
And that was a breakup song. And so I do think there's a period, right as you start to sober up, that you start going, you know, I just don't know if you and I really were a good fit.
Yeah, yeah. It's we're still like we're doing well, but it's our hardest times have definitely been since I stopped drinking it's not from who I am. It's just that I fill my time with so much stuff, and so does she. Because she doesn't drink.
Well, I don't know if we asked or talked about this last podcast. When and why did you stop drinking?
I stopped drinking May. Hold on, I know the date. Man, my brain is not working very well. In May of 2010, but I know the exact date, and for some reason I'm spacing it right now. But yeah,
2010.
Yeah.
So it is still fairly recent for you.
Yeah, I'll be 5 years sober this summer.
Oh, keep coming back. It works. Did you do the AA thing? Or
I actually went to the Arapaho House, which was an outpatient treatment thing, but only for a few days. And
you went, fuck it, this isn't for me.
The hard part was that it was what was free, like what was part of my healthcare plan at the time, because I couldn't afford it any other way, and I had to take time off of work.
Mm-hmm.
And the people there were court-ordered to be there. Everybody in the class was court-ordered to be there. I was the only person who had checked myself into it. And in Colorado, you can't – if you willingly check yourself into a treatment program, you can't go inpatient.
Uh-huh.
So it was all outpatient. I was just driving there. It was out in Aurora. And there were a lot of kind of like it was very I'm a victim of everything type of feeling, and people like the person who did the classes, the therapist and stuff, was just wrestling with people like talking and stuff. And I grabbed the book and read a lot of like the ideas in it, and they were very simple. And
the big book,
like there wasn't a AA thing. And then I went to therapy with somebody that kind of has a little bit of a focus on drugs and alcohol. So
you didn't go the typical York Street AA thing here in
town? No,
13th
no.
at York with that.
I don't think AA is a treatment program. I think it's a way to stay sober. if it seems like that to me. Maybe it is.
Yeah, that's when I quit drinking. I just quit on my, like, that's it, I'm done, I'm not going to drink anymore.
Yeah.
And then I went into, I didn't drink for several days, I went into DT shock.
Did you?
Yeah, and I ended up in intensive care for 3 days, strapped to a table, you know, shit flying around, thinking I see people in the room.
Bugs
and they're not, I went through the whole, you know. And then when I got out of the hospital, I started going to York Street, and that's when I just sobered up there. I went every day.
Were you a daily? An everyday drinker.
Yeah, I went every day with, you know, my coffee, which I think gave me my coffee addiction. I think that's what happens. You just sort of switch it for.
Oh God, you know. I'm like bad with other addictive things, and I definitely think, you know, I've traded them off, whether it's for working out or if it's for food like chocolate.
Uh-huh.
Chocolate's that thing that, like, now.
Yeah.
I never had a thing for chocolate. I didn't really like it.
Is it chocolate or the sugar? I mean, I love chocolate myself, but it's the sugar. Have you seen the thing on the internet about the brain scan of how your brain lights up for drugs and it lights up for sugar?
Yeah, it's just dopamine. That's all you're doing is just charging dopamine. You know, and thankfully the side effects from eating a little bit too much chocolate. For me, it's chocolate. I don't like other types of sugar candies like lollipops and things like that, but like dark chocolate and stuff like that.
Then I've got something for you upstairs. Because I'm the same.
You got what I need, man?
I got dark chocolate for Christmas. The girlfriend gave me dark chocolate covered macadamia nuts.
Oh, get the fuck out of here. That
they're so good.
Yeah. Listen, this just turned into your ladies' podcast.
Yeah. And I just lured him down to the basement with candy, ladies and gentlemen.
I think, like, that was the – but the AA thing wasn't just – I mean, I've had a lot of people that go to AA come to my shows because I talk about sobriety and stuff and, you know, invite me out to meetings and stuff. And it's not – for any other reason, just time. I just haven't had a chance. And I think that's where you and I were different. You drank every day, whereas when I drank, my drinking was a problem. So I couldn't binge,
okay, it's the weekend.
Yeah. Or middle of the week, and I can't stop. So I would drink so much that I would, like, my heart would go into an arrhythmia. You know, five times I've been to the hospital where I had drank myself to where the bottom chambers of my heart would stop beating.
Wow.
So.
You had to quit. It was for really health for you.
Yes, it ditto for you. I mean, I'm sure it was.
No,
it was,
but not like, all right, I'm going to the hospital. Mine was just a general. My doctor said, this isn't good for you. You know, you're killing your liver, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But I'd never been like, woo! Clear.
Yeah. They threatened to, you know, electrocardiovert me and chemically cardiovert me all the time because when your heart goes into, it's called atrial fibrillation, mm-hmm. which is pretty common. It's AFib, and they call it holiday heart. Doctors refer to it too because they see more cases of it around the holidays
when people party too hard.
And I would just be smoking and drinking. It'd be 5 a.m. and I'm still drinking by myself. And then all of a sudden, I just would be like, my heart would just
start,
like, fast. Because what happens, the
kick
bottom
kick it in like
part,
a diesel engine.
Yeah, because the bottom, you know, your heart goes bottom top. So it's goop, 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 goop. What happens is the bottom just sits there and kind of twitches.
Uh-huh.
And then the top part overcompensates to pump. And what they worry about is that all this blood pools in the bottom of your heart. And you can have a stroke when it starts back up. So for like 48 hours, it would stay like that. My heart would just be the top. It makes you dizzy. And you know when you're nervous and your heart flutters?
Uh-huh.
It feels like that about 18 times a minute. Like that fluttering your heart does that makes your stomach kind of like.
So it's almost anxiety?
Like it feels – that's what it would spark my anxiety. So then I would have to take – medication to keep my panic attacks down because the sensation would make me nervous. And so, like, it was this thing where for 48 hours, and I could literally be like getting up and my wife would be helping me around, Crystal would be helping me around, and then all of a sudden after 2 days I'd just be like, it was almost like I took a normal breath, like just like, and I'd be like, it's gone, and the bottom part would just start working. But if it didn't go back, after 48 hours, they have to paddle you.
Oh, to get it back to a nice normal rhythm again.
Or they do what's called a chemical cardioversion, which is they stop your heart for a couple seconds, then restart it while you're awake.
Oh, that's like shit off Grey's Anatomy. Yeah, like, we've got to kill him to make him better.
Yeah, they literally, like a buddy of mine had a problem with a valve in his heart, and he had to have everything totally like stopped for a minute and then restarted. And he was like, it was weird. It was like,
did he have any kind of vision? Did he have?
No, he said it felt like that he was coming out of his pores. He felt like it was like just like, and then he sucked back in to himself. Like he was just like, it was a very bizarre sensation and terrifying.
Yeah, kind of wonder if it was like that, you know, like the show on TV where you die and it goes toward the light.
Yep, and then pulls you back.
Yeah. Oh, shit, that was close.
It was bizarre. Even the sensation of the heart stuff is so, it's uncomfortable, so uncomfortable. And so I, like, the last time it happened, like, it was a doctor who did what I think doctors should do more often, which is he came in. We looked so trashy. It was late. My son and wife are there, and I had been hungry. So now I'm in the emergency room with the EEG and EKG.
All wired up.
Yeah, uh-huh. Sitting there. And he comes in, and I'm eating Taco Bell.
So this was still heavy bent and not healthy bent.
Right. Or just a little more unhealthy, a lot more
unhealthy bent.
And he came in, and he was like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I'm eating. And he's like, what happens if I had to do some medical procedure on you? I didn't tell you to eat. And then he looked at the chart and saw my medical history of this happening. And he was like, I see this has happened quite a few times before. And he was like, when are you going to stop clogging up emergency rooms with this bullshit? And just walked out. And I was like, whoa. And Crystal looked at me and I was like, holy shit. Like, and it's what I needed to hear.
Yeah.
You know, like.
Like, just die or don't.
Yeah. Like, just leave us alone. Like, I've got real patients to deal with, and you're in here acting like a moron. And so, that was like a big wake up, like a big wake up call. And then what finally got me to quit was just the night I went off the deep end and, like, flipped out on Crystal and was like holding her down on the couch. I didn't hit her, but I was like holding her down, yelling in her face. We'd gotten an argument. I barely remember it, but the thing I do remember is looking over and seeing my son standing in the doorway watching. I was like,
heartbreak.
Yeah. And then when I woke up in the morning on the floor and they were both gone.
That's like one of those bad scenes from a movie.
Yeah.
You know?
It was so indie movie-esque.
Yeah. Where you look up and the kid is in the doorway.
He's like just watching. And because I had been yelling.
Yeah.
And he's just sitting there. And I woke up that morning. They were gone. She had left and took him with. And I just called my work. And I was like, I can't come in. And they were shocked, you know, because I'm kind of like I am all the time. But then, you know, when I party, I would get nuts.
Right.
And then I called her and she's like, I was like, I'm not going to apologize. And she started to get mad, I think. And I was like, I'm not apologizing because it means nothing. I don't have any more apologies left in me. I don't have the ability to say I'm sorry anymore.
Yeah. At one point, the sorries don't mean anything anymore. It's awful.
Yeah. And so I just was like, the only thing that I can do is prove that I'm going to change. And so that was the last time. I think it was May 23rd. That's the date.
Never fallen, never skipped off the wagon.
I have every nightmare
reach
that
down
I did
off the wagon while it was riding by and scoop something up.
No. The only thing I do every so often is I will smoke pot every so often, but that was never
the problem. So
no, I don't even.
But you know what they're saying? You're just changing seats on the Titanic.
Yeah, exactly.
You're just changing seats.
Except
on the
pot
Titanic.
Is so dumb, and when you do it, you're like. Like, that's why I don't like AA. I mean, I think everybody has to know their demons.
Right.
And I'm more into depressants. And, you know, pot is a stimulant. And so I can't do it a lot. I probably smoke. When I say I smoke pot, once every 6 months.
Yeah.
And I can't do more than that because I've just become really aware of my own heartbeat. Like, that's all.
You just sit and.
I just sit and I'm like, why did I do this? Like, and I get real tense and I'm like, I don't want to do this anymore. Introvert, and everybody's like, are you all right? Because I'm sitting in this rigid posture.
Just
like,
listening to my heart.
Yeah.
What are y'all doing? Why I'm just listening to my heart.
I can't. Why is this lint all over me? You know, there's so much. So I don't.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah. I don't get it.
But now that pot's legal in Colorado, don't you feel like you should be doing it?
Yeah. You can get summons in this. You can get a summons for not doing it here.
I miss the days now of people going, oh, you're from Colorado. Do you ski?
Yeah.
No, you never get that anymore. Oh, you're from Colorado. You get high?
You stone, bud?
You stone now?
Yeah.
No.
No, I'm not.
No, just because they made it legal doesn't mean it's forced upon
us. And it's not normal pot. I mean, that's been joked about 1,000 times. I know it. But that is so true that it is not the seeds and stems that I used to get
right
when I was in high school.
Right. It's not just dirt weed that grew in a ditch in the woods behind your house.
Yeah, or it came in a brick from Tijuana, you know, like
right.
That they peel off pieces of. I mean, this is like knock you on your face. So like if I do smoke, it's like, and when I say smoke, it's like
one
puff. And then I put it out and then I sit and like my wife and I will play Super Mario Kart.
Well, she's playing. You're listening to your heart.
Yeah. I'm driving to the beat of it. Because I can't go out. I can't be in public. The one thing that I do like it for is that once you settle into it, mm-hmm. I sleep like a baby that night. Like I sleep so well because of the jujitsu and stuff like that. Like, I just don't sleep as well, and with the stress, you know, of trying to – this comedy is –
this comedy's a bitch.
It's a bitch because – and I mean, there are people who have hard jobs, actual manual labor.
They're going, fuck us right now.
Right.
You know, they're on a roof in the summertime.
It's scary.
They're building houses in this weather.
Exactly.
Right now.
And they're actually doing a difficult job. I don't think it's hard – or physically demanding, it's scary, not knowing where your money is going to come from. And how long do you stay relevant?
Right.
And I put all my eggs in this one basket.
Right.
And I don't know how to build a house. I don't know any other skill.
I don't either. This is what I thought. You know, I went to school for art. And everything I learned about art 20, 30 years ago has changed now.
Right.
Because it's all graphic art or computer art or done on tablets and pads.
Right. All CAD stuff. All computer.
Yeah, it's all that. So even that I don't have to fall back on anymore because that was my, you know, my job. I can always do graphic arts or whatever. But at this point, no, I'd have to go back to school and that ain't freaking happening.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah. That's what's terrifying about all of this.
What about you? What do you have? You've got the band also.
Yeah, the band, but that's never
that's
making
not a
money.
Back
in,
on.
Yeah, making money in music. I mean, if it's hard to make money in comedy, it's 20 times harder to make because you're A, dispersing what you get paid over six people or five. There's that five was, people in my band.
That was going to be my next deal. Like, yeah, we're getting $1,000 over five people.
Yeah, exactly.
Paying for gas and our dinner at the bar.
Yeah.
What are we walking away with?
Not flying anywhere. Never flying anywhere.
Never flying anywhere.
No, you stay in a van because that's the only way. And then you, you know, if you can, you all cram into a small hotel room or on somebody's
floor. Stop farting. You're snoring.
But it is something amazing about that. Like even just in this band.
Spells.
Yeah, in Spells. You know, like we have a song called Jet Set, which is about how we're too old.
I just
old.
Listened to that the other day because you posted a link to it.
Yeah.
Very nice. Very good song, by the
way. Yeah. And it's catchy pop punk, whatever. But like that whole song is about how we're too old to like get in vans anymore. And we all have jobs outside of this. So now we just jet set everywhere. We're like, let's get on an airplane, fly somewhere cool. We rented a van and met up with members of this band called The New. From Denver, uh-huh. who were already on tour driving around in a van. And we met them in San Diego and played San Diego. So we used their equipment.
So you didn't have to do like a lot of bands do. They got to pick up equipment, call ahead, and have it delivered to the club.
Yeah. No, we just met up, used their stacks. We brought our guitars, cymbals, and snare, and just met up and used their equipment. They were awesome enough to let us use their stuff.
And you guys, I've heard quite a bit of the stuff, and I'm liking it because it's very punk inspired.
Yeah.
And you don't hear of a lot of that, or I'm outside of the scene. But I was very big into punk in the days, as far as, you know, the Clash and the Ramones.
Yeah. We love, like, that old sound of, like, just driving power chords.
And I can tell that that's what you guys are just...
Yeah.
Now, there's a band here in town called Grace's Period. Have you ever heard of Grace's Period?
Uh-uh. No.
They do punk versions of other songs.
Oh,
they
really?
Do, like, punk versions of Rocky Mountain High and punk versions...
Almost like Me First and the Gimme Gimmes.
Is that what they do? They do that, too?
Yeah. The band No Effects. Do you remember the band No Effects?
Yeah.
They have a side band where they do that called Me First and the Gimme Gimmes, which is probably what they're kind of inspired by to do that.
Right.
Which is awesome.
It's awesome. It's one of those bands that every time I see them, I'm just like, you just want to jump up because you already know the song. You already know the words. And all you have to do is go, you know, get on the sloop, John P. Come on, John me.
Yeah, they do a bunch of them, like, oh, country road, take me home to the place where I belong.
Yeah.
West Virginia. Yeah.
Yeah, it just hardcore.
Yeah. And that's – so many of those songs – really, when people do that, you're seeing the lineage of punk rock because that's all that people were doing when they started punk bands was speeding up old blues and rock tempos to just – to that's all it is. If you slow them down or you play chords, like actual open chords rather than power chords, it's just going to sound like a rock song, you know?
Right.
Like all of it is. That's why when people are like – it's like make punk to be more than it is. It's just more aggression in it, but just playing faster tempo.
Right. To take out your anger of the day. Well, it's more like it was youth oriented.
Yeah,
I thought back then it was very, you know, the anti-establishment, very much into the black and the leather and the punk goth.
Yeah.
Which you guys look totally the opposite. It's like you guys went for 1950s home life in your look, but the music still stayed with the leather and safety pins in the face.
We get all our stuff off of Loudmouth Golf equipment, so it's like all of they're all golf shirts.
Oh, I thought maybe y'all had them made. So matching.
No, we got them all off of Loudmouth Golf, which has these amazing like loud pattern shirts, so they look almost Argyle, and then like white pants or black pants with this. They're very, like, retro-looking patterns across the front of it. And that's just – we don't take ourselves too seriously. The like, every band I've been in, there's always one or two people that just take it way more seriously and forget that this is supposed to be fun.
Right.
And this is the first band I've been in where it's – everybody gets it. Like, everybody is like, if we can't play a show or we have to cancel, everybody's breezy.
Screw it.
Yeah. Who cares? Like, and if something breaks during a show, like we did a balloon drop at our album release party, which failed miserably. We spent so long setting it up, and I went to pull the string, and the string just snapped. So now we've got this bag of balloons
just
hanging
up in the roof.
Up in the roof. And the crowd, like, tore it down.
For you.
Yeah. Like, somebody jumped off the bass drum, grabbed and ripped a piece, and then somebody jumped up again and pulled it. And the place just went mental, and it was absurd. And we're all laughing. Who cares, you know? Like, you're supposed to be having fun.
Yeah.
It's Denver. There's not record label execs at shows. You're not going to find that. Like, you might as well, the best way. That's why Seattle scenes, that's why Memphis, that's why these scenes that had amazing art and culture explosions, Detroit. Those are the scenes that really bred it. Not L.A. and New York. People moved there.
Right.
The scenes, these truly insular, like, amazing music scenes
happened to satellite cities.
Exactly, where they thought nothing was going to happen, and they didn't try to create something for somebody else. They were all just like, fuck it, let's have a good time. And like, next thing you know, that like de-emphasis on like this, the importance of getting signed and all of that, ended up making it truly amazing.
Well, that's what you see, I think, more of now, even with real record labels, is they want to know what you've done back home.
Right.
Like, what is your following? What are you bringing to us? What are you bringing to the situation?
Right.
You know, are you the biggest act in your town?
Right. It's like watching a show like I watch outrage shows, like shows that I'm just specifically watching because it outrages me. I don't know if you do that, but stuff that just makes me angry.
Okay, like an example of?
The Voice.
Okay, all right.
Where I hear interviews with people and they'll be like, I want to get a record contract.
That's
why? What? All you're doing is putting yourself in an insane amount of debt. You know that you owe them that money.
Right. And that record contract puts you as their slave.
Exactly.
You're going to record the songs that they pick for you, the producers that they want. It's not about your art anymore.
Right.
It's about I'm signing on with them and I'll
they're not evil.
I'll make the omelets that they give me the eggs
for. Exactly. They're not evil. What they're doing is hedging their bet. Nobody knows who the hell you are. You know what I mean? So if they could lose out big time on that.
Right.
Now, your best bet is to become undeniable to the point where they have to give you an amazing deal just to squeeze as much out of your profits as they can. Like, so that if you get to a point where you have this grassroots following and you've got a bidding war over you, you're going to get a better deal than just like going in and somebody's like, I'll take a chance on you. Your best bet's just to create. It's the same. How many comics I know that moved to LA with nothing under their belt?
Yeah.
They can't even conquer a local scene and they're moving.
Well, that stuff blows me away anyway. That
yeah.
kind of. You know, to not have something and hope it's just going to happen.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But I think as far as the music thing goes, everything starts to sound the same if you go to a record label. And I didn't notice this till the other night. The girlfriend put on a station called One Hit Wonders of the 2000s. I think it's on Pandora or one of those kind of
yeah.
internet. But every song sounded like a Britney Spears song.
Yeah.
They all had that same kind of the same beat, the mm-hmm. same auto, a little bit of auto tune to the voice, a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, that kind of
pop
it all
music.
Had that same. And I think that's what's happening now. Once I noticed, I started listening because all the pop music kind of sounds the same. The country now sounds like pop because that's what sells. It's like every genre almost sounds the same, so people buy it.
Well, Taylor Swift is a prime example. And I'm not knocking her. A lot of people take – she's just somebody who's trying to – she's a business person and she is a pop artist. And so her job is to cross over and sell as many albums. But to say that Taylor Swift was ever a country artist
– ever.
Like, I don't understand how that – maybe it wasn't the country that I – you know,
yeah,
that you and I –
what country was she from?
Yeah, exactly.
Not the South part.
But when I hear, like,
you're
staying up too late. Where does this crossover – there's no crossover. This is just on the shores of pop.
Yeah.
It's not
yeah. –
it's not like she's
yeah.
building a bridge. That is pop music. There's no – that doesn't sound anything like country music.
Well, there was an article just recently, and I can't remember what I read it in, but it was a high school friend of hers – that they wrote songs together years ago, and she said that this is the Taylor that everybody knew back then, this new pop album.
Yeah.
Is that she's finally doing what she always did. This,
right.
She's come back around, and she's hoping – this girl that wrote the article said she's hoping that they can hook up again because these were the songs that they wrote in high school because Taylor was a pop act. That's what she wanted to be, and
yeah.
they just said, we're going to put you in country.
Right.
So now she's actually doing what she set out
to
do.
Well, yeah, and on The Voice, she said something to the effect of, like, I'm a storyteller in my music. I think you're missing the point of what – like, the country music is amazing because they were some of the most amazing storytelling musicians. It wasn't just putting a twang on your voice. You know, like, that wasn't what made it great.
Yeah.
There's truly, like amazing – writing and the ability to tell a great story
yeah.
is what I imagine country music to be. And when I watch The Voice, I watch it because I like music and I want to stay current on what to be pissed about or what to like.
Well, I agree. Especially as a comic, you have to be up on what to talk about.
Exactly.
You know, hey, did you see this?
And it's interesting. You get wrapped up. I get wrapped up in it. And then I get mad and I'm like, why the hell are you kicking? There's one person on it. I don't know her name, but she has this amazing old country sound. Her voice sounds so old country, and it's great. And
like
she,
can't even say the word, Loretta Lynn?
Yes.
Kind of thing,
well,
Patsy
Loretta
Cline.
Lynn even shared apparently one of her songs. Uh-huh. I saw that Loretta Lynn shared her performance on it. She did like Jolene mm-hmm. as one of her songs. I was like, yes, this has – she has that. It's not twang. It's a pain in her voice. Like, they're missing it. It's an attitude.
It's an actual pain.
Yeah, it sounds like pained.
Like George Jones, they used to say he sounds like a human steel guitar.
Yeah,
it was a cry.
Yeah, the, yeah.
You know, just can't help but just this.
It
comes
was
out,
so emotive, you know? For such a tough area. It was the only way that I think that a lot of rural areas for a long time knew how to be emotional. Was through music. It's what it always felt
like
to me.
Well, because, you know, a man isn't supposed to cry and don't show your feelings, but if you sat around at night with a little bit of liquor and a guitar and you sat on a porch and you started just, you know, singing these stories about a broken heart. Or, you
and
know,
it became the knuckle and the knot in your back. It was like you realized, like, the pain you're carrying around because of that music. And that's.
Now, do you feel that if. Because this happens, I had this conversation today. I like hurting music. I like songs about pain and heartache, and I like that. And my girlfriend goes, why do you like this kind of depressing stuff? Because I think songs that touch your emotions make you think, make your head go to a different place, make you remember a different time in your life. Not just, it's all happy and poppy and...
Yeah.
And then I recently saw another article, because much like you, I read a lot, that... Actually, they say listening to music to match your emotions is a great, great release.
It's extremely healthy and cathartic.
It's not going to make you more depressed. It's actually going to help you.
Right, right, right. It's, you know, it. What it does is it, I always think of it as three bowls of water, right? And if one hand is put in extreme cold and one hand is put in extreme heat – say there's one bowl of water, room temperature. If you put the hand that's been in cold in the room temperature water, that water is going to feel warm. Same bowl of water, the hand that's warm, the water is going to feel cold. And what I think it does is it helps you really sit deep in the heat of that pain so that when you come out of it, back to normal, things feel a little more cool again. They feel a little more relaxed.
Back to normal.
It allows you to put perspective on it, you know? And vice, if you're really happy and you listen to super happy music, sometimes you tend to snap back to a little bit of that center.
Yeah.
It keeps you aligned. And that's why I hate comedy. Part of my hatred for comedy is that comedy will never be transcendent like music because it relies solely on a laugh. And if you're not getting laughs per minute, clubs don't like that.
Right.
And so we all fight for that. I do it on the road. But yet, music, I can have a show that's very tongue-in-cheek and whatever. But a lot of the songs I write are very dark. Like, even Jet Set is funny, but it's more about me wanting to, like, the bridge is I want to get real gone. Basically, I want to get out of here. And, like, songs, like, I wrote a song about riding motorcycles where it was like, I don't think I can be anchored anymore, just sitting here picking at my scabs and like my wounds, and just I want to get out of here, like get rid of everything, get on my motorcycle and just ride around for the rest of my life.
I think a lot of people feel like that though, because I've actually had days that I look around my house and the stuff and the cool stuff that I actually have accumulated over the years, I go, I think I'd like to dump it all and move into a one bedroom apartment again.
Yeah,
seriously, just to go like I'm flushing it all, and I would like to come at life from a different angle again.
Yeah. My dad called me after he'd moved, or when he was moving, and they weigh the moving truck, you know, to tell you how much
you're going to charge you.
What weight's on the truck. And I don't remember what it was, say 35,000 pounds of stuff or whatever. And he was like, we own two human beings. Own 35,000. When you hear what you own in weight of stuff that you're just this sack carrying magpie that's just dragging all your possessions. I'm a ferret. I've got shiny objects. Like it gets, but we all do it because those are the comforts.
Yeah.
But that's, I think, why I'm so fascinated by the Western culture and Native American culture. And I'm sure we've talked about that. Why Western movies and why books about the West. There was an openness and this wandering sense of like just moving from place to place.
Yeah.
Like the Navajo are direct descendants of the Anasazi who like just disappeared. They were the first real like native culture to in the Americas to dig in and use foundations in North America to like actually build. And it was because they lived, they kind of flourished in this valley that had this 150 years of water. And it was so lush and green, they set up homes.
Said, let's just stay here.
Yeah.
I like this neighborhood.
Then a drought came.
Navajo Hood.
Yeah. Well, that was Anasazi. Yeah. And then drought came. Wiped them all out. When they found the Anasazi ruins, when they first discovered them, it was like they looked like they had just disappeared.
Just there was walked still, away from it.
Yeah, there were pots still on the fire. It looked like fires had just burned out with food sitting there.
Well, maybe that's because the spaceships came and took them back.
Well, they didn't. They just disseminated. And ultimately, they led to what became the Navajo, who were totally nomadic because they had learned from their ancestors that digging in roots was just – like parallel to dying.
Right. Just keep moving like a shark.
Always keep moving. And Plains Indians were amazing for that. And then ultimately anybody who moved out here followed that. Like all these great fur traders and trappers, like the stories you hear of like the beaver trappers like Kit Carson and people like reading stories about those, they were always on the move. And when they'd go back, even like Mark Twain, somebody like that, they couldn't stay long.
Right.
Restless legs, man.
I think it's kind of like the comedy world. You start traveling around, you do things, you see more, you enjoy food from other places, you start experiencing life, and you're like, I can't just sit here.
Yeah, I get
just
so.
Sit here and have another bologna sandwich.
Man, I get home and I'm like, I'm always gone for a while, and then I'm like, I can't wait to sleep in my own bed, and I get home, and that's fun for about a week or two, and then I'm like, I got to get back on the road. I got to be other places and like seeing other things. Cause yeah, I just, even now I'm getting antsy, you know, like I don't feel like I'm making money and I don't feel like I'm surviving.
That, right. Now you're obviously your wife, Crystal, met you when you weren't doing stand up and on the road.
Right.
So how did she adjust or how has she adjusted to you being gone even more and more and more?
It's hard. It's hard for anybody.
Cause I'm going through that with my girlfriend right now. She met me as a radio DJ, home every day. Now I'm back on the road, and I've got to go, look, I've got to go make some money.
Yeah.
I have to be gone if we want to stay in this house.
Yeah.
So I understand. It doesn't mean I'm not lonely.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, I understand that part, too. So did at some point, did Crystal just kick in and go, yeah, I get it?
No.
Or is it still, no?
No, I mean, to be truthful, that's the things we're working on, you know, when we, you know, those are the big, deep issues. When I said that comedy will kill my relationship, that's
what you're
that's what I'm referring to. She said it numerous times because we have a son that's 10 years old or will be 10 in March. And she doesn't want to be a single mom. You know, she doesn't. I don't blame her.
Right.
When I'm gone, she does everything. And when I come back, I still want her to be equitable in the way things are done. So like she gets adjusted after 5 or 6 days of her own pace of living and doing things the way she wants to do.
Right, and you come in and disturb that.
Yeah, and then I come in and I'm like, you know, I think it's disrespectful that I like just did all the dishes and then you just – but she's different. Just for one example, she lets shit pile up and then does it all in one file.
Right.
That's me. Yeah, I'm not that. I wash, like, if I use a dish, if I lived on my own, if I was single, I would own one plate, one bowl,
one fork, one
spoon, one knife. Because I just wash them after every time I do it.
That's you're a hobo in another life.
Yeah.
You have a little meal kit.
Like a stick and bindle. When she met me, I just had an air mattress and a duffel bag. And I was so proud that I could fit everything I owned into a duffel bag and fold up my air mattress, put that in a bag. I just don't like stuff. I don't like collecting stuff. It makes me nervous. Like, because I'm like, she's like, why? And I'm like, well, what happens if we have to get out of here?
What is going to make you have to? What if we get out of here?
I don't know.
Tonight, in the night, we have to leave.
Freaks me out, man. I'm like, I'm responsible for getting rid of all this stuff. That's a lot of responsibility. I'm way too selfish for that. So, like,
Maybe you were not just a hobo, but maybe you were a Nava hobo.
Yeah, exactly.
In the past.
Well, that's why I wrote a song called Asphalt Navajo, where it was basically about like, hey, like the song is like, you know, like just about like I've got the car and a bunch of money. I've got a beat up car and money. Let's just leave all this behind and disappear. Like, because like there are times where this just, you know, it becomes maddening. The search for a joke.
Oh, I know.
And the search for, like, how am I going to, what am I going to do when I hit 50? And nobody wants to see, like, 50, 60-year-old comics is tough. It's staying relevant.
They do.
They do. I know they do. But what I'm saying is, as my age and as you go through it, you're looking ahead now, like, what do I do when I reach this milestone?
Right.
What's my retirement look like? What do I, am I ever going to stop?
Because no, you'll never stop. Unless you take the path that you're doing right now of the TV shows and the other. You could talk about that now, right?
Yeah, sure.
You're actually now going to be on True TV.
Well, no, we filmed a pilot.
You filmed a pilot.
Right. So it's up to them. They like it, and we'll see what happens. You've got great backing.
You've got great people involved. This isn't just a standard.
No, I mean, it was a full big budget deal. Thing. Yeah. Amazon spent a very, like, when they bought the show originally, spent a very small amount of money to make the first pilot. I mean, we couldn't have done it in L.A. It was like $50,000, which if you had used union stuff, you could have never. That wouldn't have even got you paid actors. You would have. This was a much bigger budget. I mean, there were trucks and trailers and all of that stuff, which I get. We see as wasteful, but now I get. Like, it employs a lot of working class people, and That's the hard part.
Does it really change the outcome of the show?
Well, the show looks much better. Yeah. The Knicks Bros did a great job, but lighting-wise, just lighting alone, what we couldn't afford to do with lighting, because we just didn't have enough. Even the gaffer there was like, or the lighting guy was like, I can't do this. When we first did it, they had, I mean, the last shot of the that we shot of the entire time is in the middle of the actual episode, and I'm getting paintballed on a lawn at night. And they made the moon, dude. I've never seen anything like that. I was pulling up to the house. I thought it was a football field with a game going on.
Like, the way it was lit up?
Yeah, it was like in the middle of the neighborhood at night, and then just, like, as I'm driving down one of the streets before I turned onto the street, you can just see this one, like, dome of light. And then I pulled around the corner, and there's trailer trucks. And when I pull up, I mean, they've got the whole lawn lit up. I've never seen anything like that. I felt like kind of podunk. I'm like,
do this for light?
And it was amazing. Two huge, those big round lights, bouncing moonlight. And then they had an orange one that gave it like a glow of street light. And there must have been 50 people standing. Or like, you know, the whole thing was amazing. And that part, when you see it now in the shots, you're like, this looks so cinematic.
Right. Compared to just a couple of lights and a camera.
Yeah, we did it very much like we would have done a web video, which it felt like it. Now, this still has the feeling like of us doing, like, friends making something, but on a much higher budget. Like, it looks like a TV show.
Well, being friends probably helps this show a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because I've always wondered what it'd be like to go, all right, you've been hired to go do this show with a bunch of people you don't know. What is the stress and the tension of acting with people you don't know?
Yeah.
But at least with buddies, you're like, hey, I screwed up my line. Let's do it again.
I did that. Like, when I did Adam Devine's House Party, it's all acting. You're in a half-hour episode, so you act, and then you do stand-up because it's like a sketch show. Mm-hmm. So you're part of the sketches, and then you do a stand-up set. It was weird, but everybody, for the most part, is very nice. There, even Adam Devine himself, the dude from Workaholics, is like a really nice guy. Most people in comedy strike me as pretty nice. There are assholes here and there, but like on our set, you know, we were working with like Maria Thayer, she was in Strangers with Candy, and she was on a show called Eagle Heart on Comedy Central or on Adult Swim on Cartoon Network, and she's been on a ton of shows. She's been in her own movies. So she's a very accomplished actor.
And a giving actor? Actress, I should say? Yeah. Oh, you blew the line again!
No, she was so nice and wants to be part of the group. You know, like, wants to, like, hang out and joke around with comics and Rory Scovel and Kyle Kinane, other comics that are doing very well. So we tried to work only with people when we cast it that had a good rapport with us.
Right.
Because that's more important. That's where funny is going to come from.
I think so too.
Feel comfortable.
That's why I think one of the this will show the age and stuff, but like the original cast of Saturday Night Live, the very original cast.
Oh, yeah.
They wrote the show, they acted in the show, and they had been a group already before.
Yeah.
And I think that's why that works so well. When you start bringing in new actors, like I just read the other day, that half the new cast has already been fired for this year.
Yeah, because it's...
Because they just bring people in and go, here, try to get along. Try to make it work.
Yeah.
Instead of just being friends, they go, we can do this. Come on.
That show just continues to try to struggle for relevance anymore. And I don't think it's hitting the mark like it used to. I think there are very shining... I think Colin Jost and Michael Che are funny as the Weekend Update. The Weekend Update will always be funny, I
think.
Right,
because it's topical. Almost anybody can sit there and write and have a good topical joke.
Yeah,
and deliver
yeah.
it well.
Yeah, and they're both so funny. But the sketches, they're losing me. The choices of, like, character people, like... I grew up during a time like when it was Farley, like when I was watching it a lot, when it was, you know, Farley, Sandler, David Spade. Like that to me was the cast that I remember.
They
being
were good too, though.
They were
buddies again. They were still buddies.
And not good stand-ups necessarily or anything like that. They were just very unique. Norm MacDonald, like, he's a great stand-up, but like just so bizarre. They just knew how to piece the character. I just feel like they don't know how to piece people together right now, but
maybe at some point there should be another show of that type brought out again. Like for a while,
like a Mad TV,
and yeah. for a while there was another one called Friday Nights
years
ago. But there was another one of those to come up to make them up their game. And
they tried to reboot it. And Living Color did it for a while, and I thought, like, even now looking back, you know, look who they launched. Jim Carrey. There are a lot of amazing...
Jamie Foxx.
Yeah, that came out of that crew of the Wayans brothers. And
did they reboot Living Color?
They tried to, yeah. They were casting for it a while ago.
And it didn't make it.
I haven't seen anything about it. I just saw people posting reels on YouTube because they had to post for casting.
Yeah, several years ago, I got hit up to be part of a cast for they wanted to reboot Hee Haw, a show a lot like Hee Haw.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It wasn't going to be called Hee Haw.
On Turner? Or?
It was going to be a syndicated – they wanted to do a syndicated show, and it was like I think they called it Hometown USA or something like that is what
cool.
they wanted. And – It never took off. It never made it. And I kind of see that certain shows were only in that time period. Like Hee Haw was so laugh-in. Like laugh-in of its time. That was just the country version of laugh-in. And you could be hokey, and the world was hokey, and the world appreciated a good dumb joke. But now I think people have gotten so sophisticated that they would go, that's just stupid.
The best shows right now, because I think this is the best time in television we've had in a long time because of Breaking Bad, because of Boardwalk Empire, because of
Sons of Anarchy.
Shows with real narratives to it. And they're dramatic shows with humor in it, but like Deadwood, the birth of shows.
God, bring back Deadwood.
Ugh.
There was talk of that.
I know.
At least another... To wrap it up, because you know how it ended.
Yeah, that was it. Season 3 shouldn't have been the end. It should have gone 5 seasons at the very least. And that's still my favorite show of all time. The writing, there's nobody that's written like that. There was just the grittiness and, man. I tried to watch Hell on Wheels.
Oh, I'm a fan.
You like it?
Yeah, I'm liking Hell on Wheels. What didn't you...
The first, bit, I felt like it was ripping off the outlaw Josie Wales. Like, that's what it felt like, this scorned guy whose family was killed and now he's on a out for revenge. I was like, this is just the outlaw Josie Wales.
I'll give you that. The first season was sort of like that. The first season didn't – I kind of went, I don't know. I don't – second one came around. Well, I'll watch it again. All right. It's better. Yeah. Then I kind of got –
You know what I loved? Hatfield and McCoys.
I freaking loved that.
Dude, that blew my mind. I was like, this is so good. Bill Paxton was amazing.
Amazing.
Yeah, so vulnerable and
scared.
And
Kevin Costner is
always awesome.
Always awesome in any Western.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about Open Range and how important and how underrated, although it's making its climb up now. Like now when you see greatest Western lists, they're starting to include Open Range.
And they should. And I don't know why they didn't do a second one. I mean,
I don't know either. But I guess I'm glad, unless the same writer wrote it, the same director, and Duvall and Costner both came back, And I thought, was it Annette Bening that was?
Yeah.
She was so good in it. Yeah. But the violence in it, as with any Western, is where you...
The best.
Yeah. It's judging a good steak. Or like good barbecue ribs are judged by the bark.
By the mess it makes.
Yeah, exactly. And it's exactly it. Westerns, I got to see a good gunfight.
Yeah.
And the Hatfield and McCoys, I love Appalachia. Like, I think it's beautiful. Every time I've been, it's amazing. And I think because it reminds me so much of home, I have this nostalgic feeling for it, of Maine, that seeing that, it was like, that's where I grew up. Like, the foliage and the hills.
Mist and the woods.
Yeah, yeah. And that's just some of the characters. Like, people with a lot of heart and very, like, hard people, but also I met some of the most amazing and grew up with some of the most amazing and some of the worst people. And that's the thing I think you get when you're cramped into a small town. So, but yeah, it's that I saw that. I was like, how the hell have I not watched this yet? And if people are listening to this,
get it.
Watch it. It's on Netflix.
I think it's, yeah, sorry, so the other night I thought I saw it on Netflix.
It's on Instant Watch. If you're a Western fan, or even if you're not,
I try to watch some of the Westerns on Netflix because there's a lot of weird,
obscure ones.
Obscure Westerns that, like, I think they were just made like a week ago in New Mexico.
Yeah.
You know, they're sort of thrown together. And I'll be watching one and I go, well, that's almost a modern cowboy outfit in the Old West. It's like they didn't have enough money to get it, so they just bought a handkerchief and put it around his neck. And it's like the budget isn't quite right to make it a good Western.
Yeah.
But it doesn't suck. Because it is a Western.
Great Westerns totally rely on art direction. They have to feel very, like, or if they're intentionally done campy, which I also like. I love the era. I still love the era of John Wayne Westerns. I still think The Shootist is one of my favorites.
That period of John Wayne. Now, if you go too early with John Wayne, like the 30s,
yeah,
like 20s and 30s.
They're hard, and they're not relevant. You know, like, even Stagecoach, which is probably one of the most important. Like, John Ford changed cinema, just not Westerns, but American cinema. This is a true American film, like, art form.
Right.
And Stagecoach, I've tried to watch. Man, I've tried to watch it. I get to about where it starts for me is at about High Noon. Yeah. High Noon is great.
Real, yeah, Shane.
Yeah, Shane's great.
Shane is another great one.
The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Those, and then I love the Dean Martin era. Don't even get me started on
me
Dean
too.
Martin.
Dean, how can Dean Martin be one of the, like, back east kind of crooner singers and make a great freaking cowboy?
Yeah,
you know, he just made a great cowboy.
Real bravo, like that. There's like a music interlude in it, and it's still like Adam, Kate Nolan, and I were talking for a while about making a Western until like Django Unchained, and he's working on another one. Quentin Tarantino's working on a Western.
Yeah, that's going to be filmed around here.
Yeah,
actually. It's going to be like right after the Civil War.
I think yeah,
it's based on.
And they were talking about that, and we were talking about making one where it's all the like pastel type, like clean, like everybody looks like they're dressed in a Western wear catalog. That era of Western movie. Uh-huh. But it is insanely violent. There's also songs in it, like the Comes a Man on a Dusty Trail.
Right.
Riding. You know
that was a very late 60s kind of period of Westerns.
Yeah.
Yeah. Almost kind of like if you took Bonanza and put it on the big screen.
Right.
It had that kind
of. Oh, and I love Bonanza.
Me too.
Yeah. And Two Mules. Like
Two Mules for Sister Sarah.
And Joe Kidd. That era of. Even Clint Eastwood had his moments where he was doing that until Sergio Leone really changed it by making it dirty and gritty and Sam Peckinpah.
Yeah.
Like the Wild Bunch.
Wild Bunch is one of my favorite
movies. Oh, yeah. Magnificent Seven. They started to really. Like, Yul Brynner was great. That's when it started to me, like, started
Monty
to go
Walsh.
Towards, like. These guys would have been tattered and dusty and, like, gross.
Right.
Because living on this would have been dry. This was pre-Dust Bowl. The another one that I saw HBO right now is Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee.
I haven't seen that.
It's pretty amazing. And it's all about Custer. And it takes place right after the Battle of Little Bighorn.
Yeah.
And then what led to Wounded Knee. And it's pretty awesome.
I'll have to check that out. I love the idea, though, of that movie that you're talking about. Like a campy kind of almost...
musical western, but it's so violent.
So violent. Where they look clean and with the blood and the gore.
I just imagine like a scene where it's like perfectly coiffed handkerchief or like an ascot and like the shirt, but just like the sprays of blood across his face and stuff. That would be... like and the song interlude in the middle of it, like almost musical, like would be brilliant.
Yeah,
but it's hard to write and to convince anybody to do unless you can convince them of your vision.
I had an idea years ago, a parody of surf movies, because surfing was so big at the time, and all those Frankie Avalon movies and all that. They all had the Rat Fink guy that come in and give himself the finger and freeze himself.
Yeah.
That was that whole little genre of movies. If you take that and move it into the bowling world and take the exact same surf movie, and they're all like, let's bowl!
Yeah.
You know, they're all dancing around this thing.
Like Hickadoola! Yeah. What was it? Like, just like the old... did you ever see That Thing You Do?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the movie that they play in and like one of those old, like...
down on the beach and they're dancing with the surfboards and stuff.
The Shrimp Shack Shooters or whatever.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, those are awesome. But it's bowling where the whole groove breaks out.
Yeah, the one guy's the best bowler. You'll never beat him.
So funny. Yeah, I think...
you just take almost the same script, just almost the same kind of script, and just move it to a different kind of...
yeah, that'd be awesome.
Because bringing back bowling would be very cool.
Oh, bowling movies are the best. They put Kingpin on and I like freak out. And then obviously The Big Lebowski.
Oh, yeah.
And but bowling movies are so awesome because bowling is so – it's fun and everybody does it, but it's so not
– right. It's something you don't really want to know. Your friends don't need to know.
You're like, we're going bowling. You want to go?
Yeah, it's like a moped. It's fun to ride, but you don't want your friends to know you do
it. Yeah, exactly. And I do want my friend. It's only fun if you're trashing it in a little way. Like riding mopeds is awesome if you're like just whipping and winding the thing around. But if you actually get a thrill out of riding a moped.
I rented one in Hawaii not long ago. Top speed, 35 miles an hour.
Awesome.
And the sound, is... but swear to God, in my head, I kept hearing, get your motor running.
Yeah.
Get out on the highway. And you're just letting you think of yourself.
And whatever comes out. Yeah.
But you feel bike-ish.
But you should sing that when you're riding it. You should pull up.
Nothing gonna make me happy.
Take the world in a loving embrace. Yeah, like, though, I love riding mopeds. And I mean, I have a motorcycle. There's been times where, even with the motorcycle, I've told Crystal, I'm like, I wish we could rent mopeds in this city. You can't rent them anymore.
Oh, you can't?
No, I can't find anywhere to rent a Vespa or a moped, just because I would rent one for a day and just burn all around the city.
Yeah, I would too. I love, because I know friends, and everybody does, it's been hurt on motorcycles, killed on motorcycle accidents. Everybody knows that. I don't know anybody that's ever been injured in a scooter accident.
I've tried to decide why that is. You're still in the roadway.
Do you
think
are.
It's the speed?
I think it's the speed. I think it's that you're lower to the ground. You can almost just jump off of it and run beside it if something's going. That's why I've thought about getting one. It's the fun of the open road, the breeze in your hair.
Yeah.
But without the fear of death.
Yeah. Yeah, the motorcycle thing is terrifying. Like buying a motorcycle and riding, you really realize how dangerous they are once you start riding. And that's part of the excitement of it, but you do have to reconcile with the fact that if you ride a motorcycle, there's a very good chance that you're going to get in an accident and that the percentage goes up that you'll be killed in that accident or seriously injured.
Well, because you have a motorcycle,
yeah.
Right? Did you buy one just recently, or
I've had it for a couple of years now.
Because I've seen a picture on Facebook of you. Question from a motorcycle guy, because I thought of this the other day, and I don't even know why. Because Harleys and that type of bike look so cool.
They're awesome.
I mean, they're awesome. They make you feel like a real biker.
Yeah.
You know, you feel like that.
It's the sound and the smell.
The sound,
yeah.
Everything. And then there is the rice burner. The bright
crotch rocket,
bright blue crotch rocket.
Yeah,
you know, and you have to have the matching jacket and the matching helmet, and you have to ride bent over. Okay, what makes the two different? Why is there crotch rocket people compared to biker? Because I would never...
Cruising. Like I cruising, would never, yeah. Cruiser bikes are about... They, you know, Harleys will move, but it's more about the sound and the muscle out of them and the culture of it, I think, personally. I didn't like street bikes. I don't own one, like crotch rockets, but I get it now. I've sat on a Ducati 1199, and it's like you're on a spaceship. I mean, you're like lean forward. It might as well be Tron. And I get why. Now that I've got into watching like Isle of Man and like Moto GT racing, I get it. Like those Moto GP like racers and GT racers, the Grand Prix stuff, those guys like 200 miles an hour on a bike.
Well, yeah, that makes sense. But as far as just riding around town, you know, like, honey, I'm gonna run
culture.
To Target.
It's all trying to be part of a group and, you know, meet women. And a lot of very certain type of women love crotch rocket bikes. I have a lot of female friends who love street bike. I went more of the hipster route. I love the old style. I'm really into the cafe racer bike, like the old, like James Dean style motorcycle, big fat round headlights.
Right.
I just love that. Like, my bike looks like that. It's just
like an old biker movie from the 60s.
Yeah.
Hell's Angels on Wheels.
Yeah. Those, even then, they had like choppers and soft tails or even hard tails. Like they, you know, like the now or bobbers. I like, I mean, my bike is just looks like a dad motorcycle, you know. Everybody's like, it's a dad motorcycle.
When did you become a dad?
It looks cool though. Wherever I pull up, because it's got twins, the it's a what's called the transverse V-twin. So the twins stick out the side of the bike like that. So it's just the engine sticks out the side. It looks nasty. It's all matte, flat black. And it's a mean-looking motorcycle.
And you haven't taken a spill on it yet.
Oh, I've dropped it a bunch of times.
Have you?
Yeah. I'm, you know.
At what point do you drop it and go, that's it, I'm done? Have you had any of those, like, I'm close?
Just you realize how heavy. Oh, I mean, I've almost, anytime I go out, I'm almost hit by cars and people not paying attention. That's just, you get to a point where you don't even think about it anymore. You just start swearing. You're just like, what the fuck? I'll like knock on windows. I pull up beside them and knock on their windows. I've kicked cars. Like you just start to get to a point where you just expect it. People don't pay attention to other vehicles. That's why I'm surprised more people aren't killed on mopeds, because they're such a lower profile vehicle. But I think it's because if you were to hit somebody, you're doing like 25 miles an hour.
Right.
Whereas on a motorcycle,
it's a Nerf bump.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah.
You hit it and you're already pretty much just standing.
Right.
And you can't get on the highway. I think a lot of accidents occur on the highway, windy roads. You wouldn't take your moped up in the mountains, but that's
I would too. Wouldn't you just love to ride a moped up,
dude,
up to
that's
Aspen?
Why I think the islands are great. Or even going over, like Adam was just over in South Korea with Kyle Kinney, and they were doing a run of shows there, and because there's big shows for expats.
Yeah, I actually been talking. It looks like I'm in April gonna go do Hong Kong, Macau, Singapore.
Huge shows for expats.
That's what I hear.
It's so fun. Everybody says it's amazing. The crowds love it. They're excited to have it.
Because they contacted me and I'm like, I don't really, what do you, they go, you got recommended from Paulo Gatta, and he says, you know, you'll kill. And I go, so is it, who's it for? And he goes, it's for the English speaking people and the expats and the,
yeah.
And they go, we saw your stuff on YouTube, but we just want you to do what you do and you'll kill.
Yeah.
I'm like, all right, I'll give it a shot.
You'll have a great time. Everybody who goes there is like, it's amazing. Because there are American crowds who are looking for American humor. They still love American culture. And you'll get to ride mopeds. Because that's mostly what people ride. Like in Asia, there's a ton of mopeds and small 250 motorcycles. So that's awesome. I would just love
that. Awesome.
I would think motorcycle riding would be far less dangerous if there were more motorcyclists on the road.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there's not. It's a small percentage, so you're like riding amongst the distracted metal bovine of this country. People just like on their cell phones. I do it. You texted me while you were coming around the corner.
I mean, driving around the corner right
now. Yeah, I do it, and I know I do, and I lose sight of
Well, I think stoplights now, when you see a stoplight, that's just, that red means check Facebook.
Yeah.
Check Twitter.
Everybody. Check. Everybody's heads are down at stoplights.
Yeah. You have to hit your horn to go, eh.
I suppose it's too much to hope that you're all praying right now. Because I am when I get into that. I look over. I'm like, if I'm on my motorcycle, I'll like knock on the windows of the people beside me. I like pull real close to them so that they'll look over. Because I just know that I'm there. Just acknowledge. I just want you to know that I'm in the vicinity. Because that's when dangerous shit happens, is when they see me. But yeah, it scares me. But
all right, I got one question I want to ask you.
Sure.
Before we wrap up here, because there was a news article just recently, and since I have the name of the podcast Remasculate,
right?
This article jumped out at me, and I was just wondering how people would take it, and I thought about you being perfect because you have a son.
Right.
There, I don't know if you saw this article recently. A cheerleading mom got arrested for having sex with a 17-year-old.
Yeah.
Did you see this article?
I did not.
Okay. But this was this cheerleader mom was hanging out all the football stuff.
Right.
And she got involved with one of the 17-year-old high school players. And,
right.
And everybody's up in arms because she wasn't immediately arrested. Took her days to turn herself in. The police didn't go and get her. You know, they.
Right.
And everybody's like, you know, she's horrible. She's ruined this kid. And how do you feel about situations like – because I remember thinking about, as a guy in high school, did you have like teacher fantasies?
Oh, sure.
So how is it – is it different for the guy, or is it different for the – it's high school girl? Because remember there was movies like Summer of 42 where
yeah.
the coming of age.
Well, that
and
happened.
Garth Brooks had a song about
– wasn't it Pamela Smart? Was that her name?
Yeah, Pamela Smart.
The woman from New Hampshire that yeah. had like – She ended up paying them to,
yeah.
like, kill her husband.
Yeah.
Yeah, stuff like that. And then that one's tough. Without knowing the circumstances, it's hard to say. I don't think anybody in a position of power should have sex with a high school student just because culturally that's what
I like
I've been,
your point on that.
Yeah. But do I think it's different than a – I think a lot of the situations with men tend to be much more predatorial. Like, you guys tend to – if it was an older male teacher and a female, it tends to have a feeling of power.
Creepier.
Yeah, because I think men tend to try to dominate things. And I'm not – just in our culture, I feel like a lot of times in those situations, boys are already interested in being sexually active. A 17-year-old boy – is pretty strong, you know.
Hormones are raging.
Yeah, he's also just physically able to defend himself by that point. I think a lot of times with women, they're not. Like, even at my – I was talking to Crystal about this, and she – you know, everything that's come out in light of, you know, all the conversations about whether or not jokes about rape or sexual abuse are acceptable and what happened with Bill Cosby and stuff like that. I asked her, I'm like, how often when you go out on your own to a club or anything, do you worry about that? And she's like – I mean, just part of being female. You're always worried. You have to be worried about it. I'm not like
I can
to
see
a point.
That. Like, you're not going to be so worried with fear you don't do it or can't have a
no,
good time.
But you're
but
always
you have to
aware.
Be aware.
Yeah. Whereas guys don't know that sensation, you know, because I'm not worried about being sexually assaulted by a woman when I go out. I never have that fear.
You've never had that fear? You walk in like, I'm the only man in here.
Yeah, I'd be like, hell yeah, I'm the only man in here. But if a woman walks in and she's the only, like, in a club and she's the only female amongst dudes, she'd be like, oh, Jesus. You know, so I think
right.
there's a sense of, like there's a feeling – because of that, that anything involving men is more predatorial.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that a woman can't – maybe she did. You know, maybe later on in life it'll be something that will mess with him. It's hard to know, but I don't know.
Now, if Milo, your son, came home at 17 and you found out that his, you know, 30-year-old teacher had
– sex with him?
Would you be like, high five or like – oh.
No, I'd be concerned about him. If it was a teacher, I'd worry about like a person in power and what he's being told and things like that. What's she saying to keep it a secret? That kind of a stuff. What kind of mind things? Because that's where I think it comes in. Like, I would be more concerned about his future well-being. I would be, I admittedly, though, and because I'm part of society, would be far more fucking concerned if I had a daughter. And
exactly.
I would kill the
I
guy.
I would too. I would.
Like, I would – there would – the question of like – and that's a weird thing. I would be concerned for my son. I would be – you know, I'd want to talk to him about it and make sure that he understood, and I wouldn't want it to continue.
And then you'd high-five him as he walked away.
I don't know that I'd high-five him because I wouldn't want to condone that. But I.
But this is what I. This is kind of what got my brain going as I was reading.
I bet his buddies high five him.
You know, he got high five so much he needed medical attention. You know.
Yeah, his hand. The only injury he sustained was from high fives.
But from reading all the comments under the article, there was all the women's comments were all like, she should be thrown in jail and the key, you know, throw the key away, locked up.
Maybe we should listen to them. They're the ones that know what they're thinking.
Well, that's the other thing though, And fathers would be like, yeah, I'm concerned, but good for you. So
yeah.
I'm wondering if that's part of the societal thing of the switch in the manliness of the attitude of like if these single moms are the ones in charge of these boys, are they raising them much more
much more
sensitive and aware if to where a guy would have been, hey, you did what with your teacher? God, I wish I was you.
No, I mean, I don't think so. I think women are saying that because they have a sense of, like, wanting to protect children. I think it just comes from, like, they're more allowed to be in touch with their emotions. Like, we give them more
– exactly.
The carte blanche to be sensitive and emotive, whereas guys don't get that. I would be if it happened to my son, I would be concerned for his well-being. I mean, in case in point, like we talked about with Pamela Smart, she brainwashed this kid into shooting her
exactly.
husband. So I would worry about what was being said, but I wouldn't necessarily worry about so much of a long-lasting feeling of being victimized with a guy.
Yeah.
Because I don't think – I think a lot of victimization for women – just I'm not a woman, I don't know, but from what I've read and heard from when they speak about this is a feeling of helplessness, that they can't defend themselves, that something was taken and they couldn't fight back.
Right.
And I don't think a guy worries. I mean, I think even the 17-year-old kid probably had the hubris enough to feel like I'm not in danger here.
Right. Or
she's
I can actually see the 17-year-old kid being the initiator.
Right.
You know, at one point, like, hey, Mrs. Johnson, you're kind of hot.
There's a lot more fear for women. And I think there's a lot. I wouldn't high five my son. I would leave that to his friends. Let his friends take that. But would I, like I said, would I be as concerned? If that happened to my daughter,
Shotgun time.
I
agree. I just, from those comments, I could just see that. What the difference was, guys were all the guys and the fathers. You could tell. Well, if that happened to my son, I would say, "Way to go, son!"
Because it's a huge
chip
child
off the old block.
it's a fantasy for kids.
Yeah, so I could see the difference between who was posting, and that's what made me think about how men are reacting or how we're
But I think sex was confusing enough as a teenage dude with women. I would more worry, like I said, about his emotional well-being because, like, the fact that he probably would get real wrapped up in this woman. He probably did
fall
if it
love.
Happened. Yeah, fall in love. And that's when teenage boys get crazy.
Yeah.
And that's what I would more worry about is him reacting from the feeling of loss.
And then I fell in love.
Yeah.
And then I killed her whole family because I wanted her for myself.
That's what I'm saying. That's what a guy would do. He's more likely to lash out, whereas you feel like – if it happened to a daughter, it feels like women tend to turn in on themselves a lot more and become much more self-destructive because of why didn't I fight back? Why couldn't I stand up for myself? Like this feeling – and I'm just – like I said, I don't know, but just from reading what women write about experiences and hearing from people I know that have – it's a much more victim sense, and I think a dude would be like, why can't I have that? And it becomes – teenage boys are so fucking weird and scary.
Testosterone does weird stuff.
Oh, dude. They're like chemistry experiments gone horribly awry.
Well, that's one of the reasons I've said, like so many people want to – don't be a little boy. Don't act like that. Don't be so rough. Take out dodgeball. Do all this stuff. And – you're not going to change them. They're chemically induced little violent little creatures.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? When you're 13 to that 16, 17, testosterone is kicking in. You either want to fight or fuck something.
Yeah.
You know, that's what
even
you
when they're young, like my son's age, like 9 or 10, he would much rather wrestle than do anything else.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying little girls don't want to. I don't have one. But I'm saying like he from the – he just wants to roughhouse.
Right.
Like,
and we're trying to take that out of him. Like,
he'll just jump
on
my back and stuff. Yeah, I mean, my wife and I have that conversation about him getting hurt and stuff like that. And he needs to get hurt. But I would say the same about if I had a daughter, I'd be like, let her get hurt. Let her get injured. She plays sports if that's what she wants to do. Like, yeah. The same with a boy. I'm like, just let him get nailed in the face once in a while. He's going to learn not to do it again.
Well, I think we've become this society in this day and age is that we're not afraid to just make another one. You know, I think that the old days, you know, I remember as a kid, my dad giving me a gun, a real gun on our farm and going, don't kill yourself. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
I think their attitude was, we love you. We'll miss you.
Yeah.
But don't be an idiot.
Yeah.
I think now we've just become, oh my God, this is the most important thing, and I would die. You know, I understand that feeling, but
yeah.
I think there was a difference of like, you know, he's an idiot. We'll just make another one.
As an example, safeguarding your house, I have friends who are very like into like safeguarding the house to everything, like the points of their counters. They put the little
corner plastic rounded corners on it.
Light socket covers. I've never had one.
Right.
My son played with a light socket once. It's the only time I've seriously shouted at him.
Yeah.
And it was a, hey, what the fuck are you doing? And he pulled his hand away. And I was like, if I ever see you touch that again, he's never done it again.
Yeah.
He's never played with a light socket.
Yeah. But I think sometimes they have to. I grew up that way of learn. You learn from your mistakes.
Yeah, well,
you
I don't actually want him to electrocute himself.
No, but you.
Yeah, but the fact that he was playing with it and attempting, my reaction was him learning.
Right.
Was safeguarding the house.
Yeah.
I never had the things over the stairs. Maybe that was a bad parent, but I never did. He wasn't allowed to go up the stairs.
Yeah.
If I see you going up the stairs, I'm going to get pissed.
Yeah.
He's learned to be more afraid of the reaction.
I have a bit that I do every once in a while about a friend of mine child-proofing the home. He had a woman come to the house. This is for real. With a clipboard, she walked all around, noted everything. Like you said, the corners, the drawers.
The
drawer locks.
Yeah.
Needed all this. And it cost him $800 to have a professional come assess the house to child-proof his house. I go, I child-proof my house for free. It's called a belt.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what, you know what I mean? Don't touch that. Bam. Don't touch it again. Bam. All right, fine. Touch it. Ow. You won't do that again, will
you? Yeah.
All that was free.
Yeah, yeah.
Every bit of it was free.
I'm willing to bet that when you remove the corners off of cupboards, the first thing that kid does is whacks his head into the corner of it because the cover has always been there and he's been able to do it.
Right.
And that's the thing. Like, you can touch that part of the wall where an outlet is when it's covered with a wall protector. You can't when it doesn't. So you learn that lesson. You're just, to me, when you do that, you're postponing lessons that they're going to have to learn. I think we belittle kids. Kids are real intelligent all the way from the age of 2. I think they're sponges.
Yeah,
they learn.
Once they start putting things together and how they work and open and close and right and wrong. And
you were a man in other cultures and in our civilization, you know, a century or two ago, at the age of 13.
Yeah.
You were considered a man. It wasn't common for your family to leave and for you to watch siblings and to make food in a wooden house with a wood stove.
We go back to our love of the Westerns again. But,
yeah.
You know, hey, I got to go on a cattle drive. I'll be back in 6 months.
Right.
You take care of the house, young man. Yes, sir.
There were a million ways to die out there. Like that movie, you know,
yeah.
A Million Ways to Die in the West. There were hundreds of ways to die
hundreds.
Every day.
Snake bites.
Yeah.
Fire in your
alone, in all the variations of fire.
Fire. And fire killed
illness.
And ruined so many things in the Old West.
Preparing food wrong would have killed you so quickly. Cross-contamination. All the livestock feces and everything. Mixing with your food. Everything. If you didn't cook things properly, you would have died in 8 million different ways. And they survived and flourished.
Right.
And it's like now, I agree. I think I've said this before. I think that is part of what it's all part of adaptation. And I really do believe the whole end goal of species, of our species, is for total proliferation, for us to just make as many as possible. We're all ingrained with this instinctual thing to just reproduce. And I think these are all about securing numbers.
Yeah.
Like making sure that numbers don't dwindle.
Right.
Because the whole end goal is to make as many human beings as we can.
Right.
And these are just the ways – it's why after every major war is there the great
boom.
Population explosions.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's necessary. Maybe violence is necessary because what violence does – it causes humans to become much more reactive to violence. If you look after every one of these, people become so engrossed in how important preserving life is.
Right.
And you wouldn't have that. I have a bit about that where I say people need to stop thinking that Mother Nature is a matronly person, that it's a mother. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They need to stop thinking that Mother Nature cares about you. She doesn't care. Mother Nature is a business person. It's more like an Asian businessman with an abacus and revolver just picking people off going, a little death is good for business.
Well, if you think about it, Mother Nature would be a lot like a dog just trying to shake biting fleas off of it.
Right.
You know? Just hold on and hope you make the ride.
I don't even think it's that. I think what it does is that it evolves and continues to continue whatever trait is good for population growth. And violence, up until this point, has proven to be very beneficial for population growth. Anybody who says it isn't needs to just look at the numbers.
Well, violence makes you aware of your surroundings. If you think
right.
there's violent things or you could die violently, you're very aware. And it just made me think a while ago when you were talking about fire, like maybe you could die from fire. Kids actually had a fear in the past, real fear. Fear of burning up in a fire, starting a fireplace, fear of bad food. Now kids are afraid of gluten.
Right, right, exactly.
You know? But it's, they don't have real
fear. But it's
fear.
Because we've, in a lot of ways, knock on wood, we've mastered fire. Fire departments now don't have enough fires to respond to unless you're in Detroit where it's arson. I mean, we've mastered fire to a lot of ways. We've fired. So now the next thing to move on, health. Our food is killing us. So it's like in a lot of ways, like in an effort to grow it, we made food that was bad for us. So now we're safeguarding against the food that's bad. It's all of the negative things is all part of a pendulum swinging. It swings to the negative, which causes a bigger swing into protecting against that.
But don't you think that's a very American way of thinking? Because we're all about all this extra food and how to make it last in the storage. And this bread will stay longer, you know.
But
in Europe, which is already thousands of years old, they're like, hey, let's go make some fresh bread today and pick up some cheese. And
because
we'll
it's
grab a
fresh.
Little bit of, it's
the problem
fresh.
Is not
– is it the American thinking of like we need to make it just
– we're a little nascent
storage.
Country, right? So they went through their own period of growth. We're now really just at the beginning of an industrialized – they've been through all of that if you think about it.
Yeah.
And I think that what we're finding right now is that each culture has its own civilization, but ours is spreading pretty fast.
Right.
I mean really it came with the New Deal. It was about – and the war. The advances they made in food to be able to feed soldiers ended up being sold to the private sector, which was basically freeze-dried food.
Yeah, like canned goods started coming more and more.
Yeah, like
frozen TV dinners,
preservatives.
Stuff and
how do you make food last for a long time in a wartime theater?
Spam, baby.
Yeah, shit like that. A lot of times had a functionality in it, and then what becomes function becomes fashion and becomes pop culture. And I think what we find now is that, you know, you look at modern laundering came from like how we launder clothes came from. Wartime.
Right.
The modern psychiatric medicines came right after the war ended. A lot of the war caused violence, causes a huge burst forward of ingenuity and life. And I really think it's necessary. That's a dark thought, but it's.
So, ladies and gentlemen, Ben Roy is saying we need more violence
in
society.
I'm saying. And this is the last point I'll make, and I have a bit about this.
Okay.
Last point I'll make is people think that violence is killing us, but it's not. If you look at the numbers, 240,000 people die every day, but 400,000 are born. And nature would kill 7 out of 8 out of 10 if it had the choice. But we don't. We've made advances in food and technology and neonatal care. Now 8 out of 10 babies survive, right. 9 out of 10. It's not our dislike for each other that's killing us. It's our love.
Love for each other. Our love, love is killing us, ladies
it
and
is.
Gentlemen.
And that's the way to do it.
Yeah! So, Ben, here's the time to promote. Tell people what you, how to find you, what's coming up in your life, what's going
you
on.
You can find me at www.benroyyellsalot.com, which is actually my website. You can follow me on Twitter, benroy00. Also, you can follow my band, spellsrules.bandcamp.com. Or spellsrules.blogspot.com. And I've got some shows coming up around here. I've got the dates.
Are you and I still doing the show together? I don't know.
Yes, in February.
So.
I thought we were, right?
Yeah.
And then you and I will be doing a show together in February, which is going to be a fucking blast.
Yeah, I can't wait for this.
Yeah, and
and I think we're going to do another one. I just found out today. Are we doing the benefit for Deacon?
Deacon, yes.
So you and I will be
Jake's
doing that.
Jake's a fellow comic who's been diagnosed with mouth cancer.
Yeah.
Who's fighting it bravely. He looked great yesterday. So
good.
So it'll be cool to help him out. That's in January
29th.
At Jake's. But yeah, and then just be fingers crossed that True TV picks up our television show.
Yeah.
Cool, man.
Yeah. Well, thanks for doing this. Always a pleasure.
Dude, I have such a great time with
talking. I do too, because I feel like there's almost a kindred kind of – we have the same kind of attitude on some stuff, and it's fun to be able to find somebody that doesn't go, ah, that's just stupid.
No.
Yeah, it's just – you know, every once in a while you'll go, that's – no, I see your point. It's good to have discussions.
You're not learning – you're not truly learning if you don't find out that you know very little.
Exactly. Bye. High five, buddy. All right, man. High five.
All right, man.
See you, man.
Later.
Well – that's it. I hope you enjoyed today's show. It's always fun to have Ben on the show, and it's always great to have you guys come and listen to us, download, hit play, whatever you do. We're just glad you're here at Remasculate. You can find us on Stitcher, Podbean, iTunes, Spreaker Radio. You can find me on Twitter at Remasculate. I'm also at Twitter at myself, at Steve McGrew. We're all over the place. Find my YouTube channel. Look up Steve McGrew. I'm starting to do a little vlog there, so you'll find some of our stuff. We're having so much fun with the social media, and I want to say thank you for joining me on the show and on social media. If you feel like donating and helping the show, please do. Find us there at Podbean, and you can hit the donate button. But I'm not going to beg you. I'm just going to say if you have fun, please donate. Keep the show alive. Just bought some new camera equipment for the vlog part of the show, and I got a new headset to record some stuff with the vlog. So it's costing me money to do things for you, but again, it's all in fun. If you want to help, please do. Guys, until next time, God bless America, and go listen to some Oak Ridge Boys. I bid you adieu.